Thanks so much. And good evening to everybody, and thanks for that very warm reception, and thanks so much for coming out to this event, and thank you as well to KPFA for organizing this great event and inviting me to speak here tonight. I am currently in the middle of my book tour, where I'm going around to different cities and across the country and speaking at venues like this about the argument of my book, which, as Mitch suggested, as Mitch summarized, is that the United States has witnessed the complete evisceration of the rule of law. And each time that I speak about my book at an event like this, I try very hard to vary how it is that I talk about it and what points I highlight and emphasize, in part because I try and cater what I'm saying to what I think are the interests of the audience, and in part it's because that's necessary to maintain my sanity, because you get very quickly very sick of hearing yourself talk about your book while you're on a book tour. So I try and vary it up and keep it interesting both for the people to whom I'm speaking and for me. And yet every time that I talk about the argument of my book, I try to begin by asking, what is it that we even mean when we refer to the rule of law? And the reason why I think it's so important to begin by asking that question is because the rule of law is one of those terms that one hears often bandied about. People will say, media figures and political figures and the like will often say, oh, of course the rule of law is very important. I believe in the rule of law. And yet very rarely is there any attention to pay to what that term actually means, to what it designates, what we refer to when we say we believe in the rule of law. And to me, this is more, this is reflective of this broader paradox in our political discourse, that oftentimes the most significant and frequently invoked terms are typically the most ill-defined, the ones free of any understood definition, and therefore susceptible to all kinds of manipulation and propaganda. For me, the most illustrative example, the supreme example of that dynamic, is the word terrorism, which has an incredibly significant role that it plays in our legal landscape and in our political discourse, and yet terrorism is literally a word that is free of any fixed or objective meaning. Basically, it has come to mean Muslims who commit violence against the United States or who otherwise oppose the agenda and interests of the United States. Operationally, that's what it means, but it has no real fixed definition, notwithstanding its centrality in our legal framework and in our political discussions. There's other words that are similar in that way, like the word militant, which basically means he or she who dies when a missile shot by an American drone detonates. That person, that's what we mean by militant. There's lots of other phrases like that. Civil liberties, due process, class warfare. These are terms that we hear bandied about constantly. They have no real meaning. They're basically terms of, they're just empty slogans. And I think the rule of law is absolutely a term that's exactly that way. So when we hear it bandied about all the time, it's very rarely understood what that term means. And so I think it's important to start by asking what it is that that term designates. And the good thing about that undertaking, trying to ask what the rule of law means, is that it's not a very complex endeavor. And the reason it's not a complex endeavor is because the rule of law is actually a fairly clear and straightforward term. And the reason it's clear and straightforward is because there is a consensus that transcends the ideological spectrum and even transcends temporal eras about what this term is supposed to mandate. And that is nothing more than the fact that we are all equally bound to a common set of rules, regardless of power, position, or prestige. So you can look to almost any source that defines the rule of law in a credible way. You can look to contemporary legal scholars, and what they'll say is that the rule of law means that nobody is above the law and nobody is below it. And nobody means nobody. Nobody is above the law or nobody, and nobody is below it. More interestingly, you can look to lectures that Western institutions and the United States have been giving to the developing world and the third world for several decades about what the rule of law requires. In the 1980s and the 1990s, there was a movement to demand that any nations that wanted to receive lending from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank had to be nations that proved to the first world, to the United States, that they were living under the rule of law. And so there was an effort made to sermonize to these countries what exactly it was that we were demanding when we imposed this requirement. And there were lots of articles written towards this end, the most significant, the most influential of which was an article in 1998 by Thomas Carruthers, who worked for a long time at the World Bank. in the journal Foreign Affairs. And this article was intended to essentially be the gospel to developing countries about what they had to do if they wanted to be deemed living under the rule of law. And what Carruthers wrote in this article was that the rule of law means that everyone in your society is bound by the law, that nobody is exempt from it. And what he also said was that the hallmark of a country that fails to live under the rule of law is that your financial elites are able to use their superior economic power to gain exemption from the rule of law. And this, he warns, creates a culture of corruption that produces lawlessness. And we were not going to lend money to countries that were guilty of that pattern. Now, I'm sure you can't even imagine what it's like to live in a country where financial elites are able to use their superior economic force to achieve exemption from the rule of law. This is a horrible thing, but try to imagine it. This is what we told those countries they had to stop doing if they wanted to qualify for these lending programs. And then you can look even more interestingly to what the founders of the American Republic said about this question. Because what's really interesting about this is that the founders disagreed on all sorts of things. They had virulent debates and conflicts amongst themselves about a whole litany of issues. And yet one of the things on which they all unanimously agreed, literally unanimously, is that the central prerequisite to having a just and legitimate society was that the rule of law would be not ancillary or secondary as a goal, but would be the central requirement, the principal mandate going forward. And what's even more interesting to me about that is that the founders were people almost across the board, a couple of exceptions, but almost across the board who loved inequality. They were huge fans of inequality, especially wealth inequality and income inequality. They thought that wealth inequality and income inequality were not just inevitable, but desirable and virtuous, which is not surprising since they were almost all very rich. But what they nonetheless emphasized was that the only way that wealth inequality and income inequality and other forms of inequality would be justifiable and legitimate is if we all began being bound by the same set of common rules before the law, that the only way that those inequalities would be the byproduct of merit rather than cheating is if, as Thomas Jefferson put it, even the poorest laborer is on equal footing to the richest multimillionaire before the bar of justice. This was continuously highlighted and emphasized by almost every American founder as the central requirement for a just republic going forward. Now, if you stand up and talk about how the founders revered and venerated equality before the law, you'll be always met with an immediate objection, which is a true objection as far as it goes, but I don't think it goes very far. And the objection, of course, is, well, you can talk all you want about how much the founders believed in the supremacy of equality before the law and the rule of the law, and yet they violently breached it in all sorts of ways. In fact, the Republic was basically one huge bolting tribute to violating that principle. And that's obviously and indisputably true. In fact, so self-evidently true that it's not worth proving, because I think everyone is well aware of it. Now, you can point out that fact that the founders espoused principles which they violated in all sorts of radical ways and argue that they were hypocritical, that that was hypocrisy. And it's true. The defining attribute, I guess, of hypocrisy is espousing principles which you fail to comply with your actions. So they're certainly guilty of that accusation. But there's another side to that disparate approach, which is that when you affirm the supremacy and validity of a principle, even if you're violating it in action, there's a positive outcome to that, which is that that principle becomes aspirational. It gets enshrined as the governing principle for how you understand progress, how you want to move forward, how you want to move toward a more perfect union. And so the fact that the founders continuously emphasize this principle that Thomas Paine said to he who asked, where is the king in America? Let a crown be placed on the head of law. That John Adams said, there's only two choices. We're either a nation of men or a nation of laws. That meant that Americans were inculcated with these political values. In fact, we learned them through cliche. So we're all taught that justice is blind, and the statue of Lady Justice has a blindfold over her eyes, signifying that she doesn't care who is before her, only what was done. The words equality under the law are engraved on the front entranceway of the Supreme Court and eventually were codified in the 14th Amendment. This served as the animating principle
for the next two centuries of genuine American progress, the emancipation of slaves, the elimination of Jim Crow, the enfranchisement of women, the improvement of lives for gay Americans, the better treatment of Native Americans. All of this happened because we were governed by this principle that the founders, even when they violated rigorously and continuously without any exceptions, affirmed and demanded be adhered to. So there's that incredibly important benefit that came from that. What has happened over the last several decades, and the reason that I wrote my book, is that it isn't merely that we violate the principle of equality before the law. If that's all that was happening, it wouldn't really be worth a book. In fact, it wouldn't be worth taking up 5 seconds of your time. It's not exactly noteworthy or newsworthy that the United States or any country is failing to comport perfectly with that principle. What has changed radically is that we no longer affirm that principle, at least not in elite opinion-making circles. Instead, it is extremely common to hear people arguing, people in influential venues, to explicitly reject and renounce the principle of equality under the law, to explicitly renounce and reject the validity of the rule of law itself. Now, when I say that to people, they sometimes have a hard time immediately believing it or agreeing with it, because you don't typically hear anyone standing up and saying, I just want you to know that I'm an opponent of the rule of law. I don't actually believe in the rule of law, so I want to have that be clear and on the record. But that isn't the form that this renunciation takes, this explicit rejection of the rule of law. Instead, the form it takes is to argue against the merits of the substance of the rule of law. The requirements that I just laid out are agreed to be by consensus the requirements of the rule of law. And I just want to give a couple of examples from my own experience as to when it was that I first realized that this was true. So I began writing about politics full-time in late 2005, in roughly October of 2005. And 6 weeks later, 6 weeks after I stopped practicing law and began writing about politics, the New York Times revealed that the Bush administration was spying on American citizens without the warrants required by the criminal law. And this was, to me, a topic of great interest. It was within the realm of my expertise. And more significantly, the reason I began writing about politics was because I perceived there was this growing radicalism and lawlessness in the post-9/11 era, that our political leaders had adopted the view without much resistance that they were all powerful in the name of terrorism, even when it came to disregarding the law. And this was a perfect expression of those radical theories of executive power. And so it's something that I began writing on almost every day. And this was the first time that I began participating in debates on the radio and even on television to talk about this scandal. It was because segment producers and some editors and the like wanted to have some nominal balance, to find somebody who was out there saying that they thought this was a really bad thing, and there weren't very many people, and they probably used Google and stumbled into me and so invited me onto these shows. And I remember at the time, and I actually confess this with some degree of embarrassment over the naivete under which I was laboring, although, as I said, it was just at the very beginning of my political career, my defense, in my career of writing about politics. I actually thought, or just assumed, that this was going to be a fairly straightforward scandal, and that the debates in which I participated were going to be fairly clear, and that there would at least be a consensus that emerged almost immediately that when the president of the United States gets caught red-handed doing exactly that which the criminal law says that you cannot do, that at the very least, that was like a bad thing to do. I know, it's ridiculous of me to think that, but that was actually the expectation that I had, the assumption that I had, and I thought when I was gonna go on these radio programs and these television shows, that the assumption of the discussion was going to be that criminal conduct had taken place and that the real debate would be over how we as a society should punish this criminal behavior. Should we commence a grand jury and indict the officials responsible, or should we simply impeach, or which of those what combination of those remedies would be justifiable given the severity of the crimes? I thought that's what I was going on these shows to debate, and I thought that's what the debate would be. And of course, I went on there and I was asked everything except that. That was exactly the issue that was not part of the discussion. Instead, I was asked things like, well, don't you want the president of the United States listening in when the terrorists are speaking to one another? I mean, don't you want that to happen? Or I would be asked even more commonly, Well, how can the Democrats possibly object to what Bush did and still have hopes of winning the 2006 midterm election? I mean, what are you wanting them to do? And I remember at the time, I was literally befuddled by these questions. Like, I was baffled. I was confused. And I remember during these discussions, and I've gone back and listened to a couple of them on occasion, because they're actually amusing in retrospect how just disoriented I was. But I kept, all I could say and all I could think and all I could offer was, I just kept saying over and over, I know, but it's against the law. It's illegal. It's actually a felony. You can go and read the statute, and I promise you it really does say that anyone who spies on the communications of Americans without first going to the FISA court and getting a warrant is guilty of a felony and shall be punished with 5-year prison terms and a $10,000 fine for each offense. And the New York Times reported that the Bush administration had spied on the conversation of thousands of American citizens on American soil. And so it seemed to me pretty obvious that that punishment was warranted. And each time I would say this, it wasn't that my argument was rejected or disagreed with. It's that it wasn't acknowledged at all. It couldn't be processed. It was like I was speaking a foreign language. And what I ultimately realized after a couple of months of enduring this was that I was speaking a different language. I was speaking the language of the rule of law, the idea that all of us are equally bound to the same common set of rules, and that all of us, the most powerful among us or the most powerless, are treated equally when they get caught breaking the law. But that is not something that we believe in, we being the elite class of media and political professionals who speak about these issues. That is not something that is believed to apply to our highest level political leaders. And that was the first time that I really viscerally understood exactly the extent to which this principle had been explicitly rejected and repudiated. And then I understood this even more strongly when, about a year later, the Bush White House demanded that not only the political officials responsible for the spying program, but also the nation's largest telecoms, who had directly participated in these programs by turning over their customers' records to the government and enabling direct spying and interception of their communication without warrants, the Bush White House demanded that they too be fully shielded and immunized from any consequences for this lawbreaking. And I remember at the time, the first day that the Bush White House demanded this, and although I was much more cynical by this point than I was at that early stage, because I had seen how we reacted to blatant, brazen lawlessness, I actually didn't think that there was any prospect that the Congress, which, by the way, was then controlled by the Democrats in both houses with large majorities, would even remotely consider, let alone vest, the nation's largest telecoms with retroactive immunity. I mean, the very concept is so radical. The act of doing that is so oozingly corrupt, so sleazy, that I thought even for our political culture, that would be a bridge too far. And yet, 6 months later, I again admit with some embarrassment, I was completely wrong, because both parties in Congress got together with the support of the current president, then senator from Illinois, who decided that although he had promised during the primary campaign he would filibuster any bill, as he called it, that contained telecom immunity, decided that once he had the nomination in hand, he was emancipated from that promise and would therefore vote against the filibuster and in favor of the underlying bill. And what had happened was the telecoms had been sued in court and began losing their lawsuits, including here in Northern California, in the Northern District of California, with a judge sitting in San Francisco. That was why they went to Congress, and Congress passed a law that had no purpose other than to say that they were going to supplant the role of the judiciary, declare that the telecoms had done nothing wrong, and immunize them from any and all civil or criminal liability, even though judges had already ruled that what they did was clearly illegal. And they passed that law. The George Bush signed it into law. They had a huge party celebrating the end of the NSA scandal at the White House, where Democratic and Republican leaders attended, and they all celebrated together that the scandal that the New York Times had won the Pulitzer Prize for had been put to bed without any consequences of any kind, because this immunity that we had seen Bush officials enjoy had now been extended to the private sector as well. And I actively participated in a lot of those debates over whether the telecoms should receive retroactive amnesty for these crimes that they had committed. And it was then that I heard directly and firsthand huge numbers of media stars and political figures making explicit arguments against the rule of law. Their arguments were that because the telecoms were so powerful and important to the functioning of our country, so necessary for the protection of our national security, that it would be not just in their good, but in our common good, good for all of us, if we decided that we would protect them from the implications and the consequences of their lawbreaking by immunizing them retroactively. And this rhetorical approach to justifying elite immunity, that once somebody is sufficiently powerful and instrumental in our country, that it is in all of our good to simply look forward to the glorious future rather than digging in the past and assigning blame, has become normalized when it comes to elite criminality. It's the exact rationale that the Obama officials, that the Obama administration has used to justify their refusal to investigate the crimes of the Bush era, from the creation of a worldwide torture regime to the aggressive attack on Iraq to multiple episodes of obstruction of justice. It's the same mentality that has led to the full-scale immunization for private sector criminals as well, including the banking industry and Wall Street executives who engaged in systemic fraud that precipitated the 2008 financial crisis. These are the most egregious crimes that can be committed: torture, lawless spying on American citizens, massive fraud, an aggressive attack on another country, and yet not a single one of them has been subject to criminal investigation, let alone prosecution. It's because we have repudiated the rule of law when it comes to elite lawbreakers. Now, this idea of this extreme leniency would be a much different story if it were applied across the board to everybody. So, for instance, let's say that you go out tomorrow and you decide you're going to rob a bank, and you go into the bank and you point a gun at the teller and you say, "I want all your money," and you walk away with $50,000. And so let's say 3 months later the police come to your home and they tell you that they have an arrest warrant and they want to arrest you because they have evidence that you are behind the bank robbery. If you were able to say in response to the police coming to your home to arrest you something like, "Okay, look, officer, you got me. I did it. I robbed the bank. I admit that. But, you know, that's in the past. I mean, do we really want to be digging around in the past and pointing fingers and assigning blame? I mean, isn't it so much more important that we look to the future and decide how we can build our community in a positive way? Do we really want the disruption that's going to come from prosecuting past crimes?" If you were able to offer that rationale, that excuse, that persuasive justification to a police officer who was there to arrest you or to the judge who was there to sentence you, I wouldn't have a problem with that approach, at least on a rule of law basis, because then this leniency would be at least applied to everyone across the board. But you probably don't need me to advise you that if anything like that happens, that you not offer that justification to the nice police officer coming to arrest you, because it's not available to you. Unless Lloyd Blankfein, the Goldman Sachs CEO, is here. Is he? No, I don't see him. So that is not available to you. That is available only to Citigroup and to Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and to the people who have engaged in mortgage fraud and who exert great political and financial power in the United States. What we do with ordinary citizens when it comes to justice and punishment and retribution is the exact opposite from the world in which the elites reside. We have created, at exactly the same time that we've built up this structure of elite immunity, the world's largest and one of its most oppressive penal states. We imprison more of our citizens than any other country in the world by far, including countries that have far greater populations than we have. The most amazing statistic in that regard is that the United States accounts for roughly 5% of the world's population. 5% of the people on the planet are American, and yet 25% of the prison population in the world is on American soil. We account for 25% of prisoners worldwide. And that's because we imprison more of our citizens for longer periods of time under harsher conditions with far less leniency, far less mercy and forgiveness than any other Western country and almost any country in the world. We imprison people for trivial transgressions that are far too insignificant to even give rise to the prospect of imprisonment. In other parts of the world, we have constructed this harsh and merciless penal state for all other Americans at the same time that we've created this template of elite immunity for our most powerful. And what's the most amazing and illustrative personification of this multi-tiered justice system to me is, as Mitch referred to, the pardon by Gerald Ford of Richard Nixon. And the reason that's so amazing to me, this was really the first time that this explicit repudiation of the rule of law, the template that we now are plagued with, was promulgated for the first time. When Gerald Ford went on television to try and persuade to an angry and skeptical citizenry why its most powerful political official should be protected fully from the consequences of his felony, he knew what he was doing was wrong and shameful. He was very shifty-eyed and sweaty and moving around in his seat. And what he said was, and this was really the start of this trend, he said, look, I believe in the rule of law. I know that the law is no respecter of persons. That's what he said. That's the essence of the rule of law. But he then added this newly concocted amendment designed to gut the very principle he had just invoked. He said, but the law is a respecter of reality, meaning that if it's too divisive or too disruptive to hold political leaders accountable when they get caught breaking the law, to be assessed and judged solely by the political leaders themselves, then we waive the rule of law, we suspend it, we give an exemption to the most powerful, which is another way of saying that we don't live under the rule of law, that we're a nation of men and not laws. And what was most extraordinary about that episode, and most illustrative, is that Richard Nixon rejuvenated his political career in the 1960s by creating himself as the law and order candidate. He ran against the disorder and disruption of the 1960s. He regularly inveighed against Martin Luther King for teaching our nation's children that it's okay to break the law if you have a good enough cause. He demanded that we stop looking at the root causes of crime, about why people commit crimes, and instead ignore all of that and simply harshly punish them. He advocated for the revocation of all kinds of parole rights, for harsher and longer sentences, for more unforgiving judges. He started the drug war by creating the Drug Enforcement Agency and a whole slew of harsh remedies that was designed to imprison our fellow citizens. And yet the same politician who created himself and put himself in power on this law and order platform, this platform that we don't forgive criminality but punish it harshly, the second he gets caught committing a crime, he's fully immunized. He never sees the inside of a courtroom, let alone a prison. And this, to me, is the very personification of the evisceration of the rule of law. One other example that's more contemporary, which is the Obama administration, and President Obama has exerted Herculean efforts, probably more impressive than they have in any other realm, to protecting the officials of the Bush administration from any form of accountability for their war crimes. They've not only blocked the Justice Department from investigating in any meaningful way, they've also protected all the Bush officials who have been sued civilly in court by invoking secrecy doctrines and immunity doctrines, and they've even brought to bear huge amounts of diplomatic pressure on other countries like Germany and Spain who wanted to investigate the Bush officials criminally because many of their citizens were the ones who were tortured and illegally detained. And the principle, the slogan that the Obama administration invokes and that President Obama specifically has repeated many times to explain this behavior is that Orwellian slogan of look forward, good citizens, not backwards. Look to the future and not the past. And what's so amazing about that is the very same Obama administration that has repeatedly invoked this slogan is currently waging what Jane Mayer of The New Yorker 2 months ago described as an unprecedented war on whistleblowers, people who in fairly low or medium level positions in government learn of acts that government leaders undertake that are illegal, corrupt, or otherwise improper, and then disclose it to the public in good conscience by leaking it to reporters or other people, like WikiLeaks. And what's amazing about that is many of these acts are way back in the past, in 2002, 2003, 2004, and yet the Obama administration has brought more prosecutions of whistleblowers under espionage claims and counts than all prior presidents combined. And so what we have is, take a look at the National Security Agency scandal that I began by describing. There's only one person who has paid any price from the systemic illegal spying program instituted by George Bush that the New York Times exposed. And his name is Thomas Tamm. And Thomas Tan was a mid-level Justice Department attorney who in 2005 learned that Bush officials were spying on Americans without the warrants required by law. And one day he couldn't take it any longer and he picked up the phone and he called Eric Lichtblau at the New York Times and told Eric Lichtblau what he had learned, which is what led to the Pulitzer Prize-winning story being published by the Times. Thomas Tan was fired from his job. He had a grand jury convened against him to investigate whether he had broken the law by disclosing classified information, meaning exposing the criminal eavesdropping program. He had subpoenas issued for him. He couldn't afford his lawyers. He eventually ended up in personal bankruptcy and with very severe psychological afflictions that he's rather heroically talked about in public. All the people who actually committed those crimes that he exposed have been fully immunized. In fact, most of them are on book tours making huge amounts of money, treated like elder statesmen, in positions in academia, including one in this very city and another quite close to here at Stanford. And yet Thomas Tan, the person who exposed the criminality, is the only one who has suffered. The Obama administration dispensed with this look forward, not backward mantra when it came to punishing the people who exposed the high-level criminality. That's the two-tier justice system personified. Now, one last point about how this two-tier justice system works, and that is that in the post-9/11 era, we have created an even lower classification than ordinary Americans get when they commit crimes. That is people who are accused of being terrorists. In that world, for that class of people, including American citizens arrested on American soil, there is no law of any kind. It is a world of pure lawlessness. They are subpersons. Subhumans, literally, who receive not even the pretense of due process the way ordinary Americans do. They can be arrested and detained and even killed without any due process of any kind. So one of the first episodes that really impelled me to start writing about politics and stop practicing law because of this growing radicalism that I perceived was when the Bush administration asserted the power to arrest American citizens on American soil and detain them without charges for as long as the president wanted. And that's what happened to an American citizen named Jose Padilla, who was arrested in April of 2002 at Chicago O'Hare International Airport and immediately transferred to a military brig in South Carolina, where he remained for the next 3.5 years without charges of any kind, and in fact held incommunicado, prohibited from any communication with the outside world, his family, and even lawyers. And he was tortured there to the point where he is permanently psychologically damaged. And this was a huge controversy among Democrats and progressives, the idea that the Bush administration would assert the power to detain American citizens without due process. That was the epitome of radicalism. Until last year, when it was revealed that the Obama administration is asserting the power, not just to eavesdrop on American citizens without warrants, and not just to detain our fellow citizens without due process, but to target them for death far away from a battlefield. And that's exactly what the Obama administration has not only asserted, but carried out when they targeted for assassination the American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed by a drone attack in Yemen after being targeted for assassination while riding in a car with two friends, one of whom was also an American citizen, collateral damage. And 2 weeks after that, al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son, also an American citizen, born in the United States, and his 17-year-old cousin had their lives ended by a separate drone attack that was sent to Yemen as well. So here we have literally the most radical act, the most lawless and tyrannical act that a government can possibly seize, literally the power to target its own citizens in complete secrecy, with no charges of any kind, no evidence presented of their guilt, no transparency, no checks or balances. This is the extreme lawless world that is inhabited by those accused of committing terrorists. At least ordinary Americans who are charged with crimes get the pretense of due process, the trappings of it. They'll get a public defender who spends an average of 7 minutes talking to them, even when they're charged with a felony that can send them to prison for decades. But people accused of terrorism don't even receive that. It is the world of lawlessness. And that is as much of an evisceration of the rule of law as one can imagine. Now, I want to talk about one of what I think is the main implication of having created this two-tier justice system. It isn't just that extreme injustice is generated when we have multi-tier justice systems depending on who you are rather than what you do, although that is true. And it isn't just that we essentially eviscerate and abandon the rule of law by doing that, although that's also true. I think it's much more subtle than that and yet much more insidious. The real implication of this development is that law ceases to become what it was intended to be, which is the legitimizing anchor for everything done in the society, the guarantor of equal treatment by our government, and it becomes the exact opposite. It becomes a coercive weapon wielded by the powerful to entrench their power and punish those who challenge or subvert them. Mitch mentioned the work that I did on the detention and treatment of the 22-year-old Army private accused of being the WikiLeaks leaker, Bradley Manning. And what happened there was I first wrote about the detention conditions of Manning in August of 2010, so roughly 15 months ago. He's still held in detention despite not being convicted of any crime. But what had happened then was he was subjected to extraordinarily harsh and inhumane conditions, held in protracted solitary confinement of the kind that the U.S. government's own studies said are guaranteed to produce long-lasting psychological injury. He was stripped of his clothing and forced to stand naked. And when I wrote about this for the first time, a lot of people asked, and I actually asked myself as well, why would the Obama administration do this? It seems rather counterproductive. For one thing, it creates sympathy for Manning where it might not otherwise exist. And indeed, the State Department spokesman, PJ Crowley, ended up being forced to resign after he publicly condemned the treatment to which Manning was subjected. It also jeopardizes their ability to prosecute him, since this inhumane treatment means that any statement he makes while in detention can be subjected to the claim that it was the byproduct of coercion. And so it was hard at first to understand why the Obama administration would do this. What motive did they have? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that the motive for doing that is exactly the same as the motive that led the Bush administration to pick up thousands of people from around the world and ship them thousands of miles away to a Caribbean island and dress them in orange jumpsuits and shackles and show the world what we were doing, or to torture people at will and be quite open about the fact and even boastful and proud of the fact that we were doing it. The reason is to send a signal. And the signal that's being sent is we, the people who run the American government and the people who control and own it, we do not act with the constraints of law. We can do whatever it is we want to you, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. And not only that, but we can use the law and manipulate the law to turn anyone who challenges us into a heinous criminal who can then be punished under the pretense of legalism and legality and law, and there's nothing anyone can do about that either. So if you're somebody who learns of something that we did in secret that is illegal or corrupt or improper, and you are thinking about exposing what we did to the world, take a look at Bradley Manning and what we were able to do to him. Or if you're a Muslim living in a Muslim country who wants to impose our bombing and occupation and invading of your country, take a look at what we've done to all of your neighbors or to thousands of people that we've arrested and put into black holes with no due process of any kind. It's a way of sending a signal of deterring anybody who might challenge or in any way meaningfully dissent from those in power. It's using law as a coercive tool to shield the powerful rather than by equalizing the playing field as it was intended to do. I think this really was vividly illustrated for me during the time that I was writing a lot about WikiLeaks. And I just want to tell this quick anecdote about what happened and how this opened my eyes in this regard. The first time I ever wrote about WikiLeaks was in January of 2010. And this was really before very many people knew anything about WikiLeaks. It was before they had even posted the video of the Apache helicopter in Baghdad slaughtering Iraqi civilians and journalists. And I didn't know much about WikiLeaks either. The way that I had learned about WikiLeaks was that the Pentagon in 2008 had prepared a report that they classified as top secret. And in this report, they declared WikiLeaks to be what they called an enemy of the state, and they plotted ways that they could go about rendering it inoperable, destroying it. They talked about exposing their sources so that nobody would have confidence leaking to them. They talked about manufacturing fraudulent documents that they would then submit to WikiLeaks in the hope they would publish it and destroy its credibility. They talked about cutting off their funding sources to choke their ability to operate any longer. Amazingly, if you look at how WikiLeaks has now been destroyed, it tracks almost completely what the Pentagon wrote in this report. Now, the way that I know about this top secret report, you could probably guess, ironically, is that somebody leaked it to WikiLeaks and they published it on the internet. And this was in early 2010. And there was a New York Times article about this report that was published. It was very shallow and not very informative, which is sort of a redundancy. I already said it was a New York Times article, but this is how I learned of it. And I didn't know anything about WikiLeaks, but my immediate reaction was that any group that has been declared an enemy of the state by the Pentagon and that the Pentagon is plotting to destroy is a group that merits a lot more attention and almost certainly a lot of encouragement and support. So I went and I read everything about WikiLeaks that I could, and I saw that they had engaged in some very impressive leaks outside the United States against other governments and corporations. And I wrote a long article detailing all the reasons I thought WikiLeaks held such promise. And I interviewed Julian Assange, and I published the audio of the interview as well. And at the end of this article that I wrote, I encouraged people to donate money to WikiLeaks. I provided a link how they could wire money to their bank account. I provided a PayPal link how they could donate online. And in response to that article, I had dozens of people, literally, in all kinds of venues, in my comment section to the article, by email, in events like this, who came up to me and said some variation of, well, look, I absolutely agree with you about what you said about WikiLeaks. I think they hold great promise. I support what they do, and I wish I could help them in any way. The problem that I'm having is that I'm actually concerned that if I donate money to them electronically, that I will end up on some government list somewhere, or potentially even be subjected to criminal liability if at some point in the future they're declared a terrorist organization, I could be charged with materially supporting a terrorist group. And the reason I found that so striking was because WikiLeaks is an organization that had never been and has never been even charged with a crime, let alone convicted of a crime. They cannot be charged with a crime because what they're doing is pure First Amendment activity. It's what the New York Times and CNN claims to do, which is receiving sensitive government secrets about high-level wrongdoing and exposing it to the world. It's the core of what a free press is intended to be. It's impossible to criminalize what they do without criminalizing what every major newspaper and media outlet does on a daily basis, although far less effectively and in far less significant ways. And yet, here were dozens of American citizens, and these are not people prone to wild paranoia or conspiracy. They're very sober, rational people. I knew a lot of them. They're my long-term readers, or could just tell by the way they were expressing themselves that they were very well-grounded, and yet they were petrified of exercising the most basic First Amendment right, which is what donating money to a political organization whose cause you support is. And that's when I realized just how potent this climate of fear that's been created actually is, that comes from the government announcing as proudly and clearly as can be that they are not constrained by law of any kind. You can offer all the rights you want on a piece of paper or a piece of parchment, but if you intimidate the citizenry from exercising those rights become meaningless. It's actually a more effective means of tyranny than overtly retracting the rights in a way that's obvious. And yet that's exactly what has been created. And I think you see the same thing with how the state and various police agencies, which are really just the arm of these elites, are responding to Occupy Wall Street and the various movements that have been created around the country. Because what you see there is the police force, the coercive arm of state power, being used not only to protect the very elite criminals whose crimes are vastly worse than any of the people who are currently sitting in American prisons, literally. They wrecked the world economy and destroyed the economic security of tens of millions of people around the world. Not only do you see the police coming out in droves and being deployed to protect those criminals rather than arresting them, you also see what is clearly intended to be intimidating and aggressive violence against people who are peacefully assembling. Because that, too, is a way of signaling to citizens that if you challenge prevailing power, you, too, can be harmed and crushed because we, the state and its agents and its owners, do not operate with the constraints of law. It's a way of coercing the citizenry and intimidating them from challenging what the state is doing. It's the same reason why Bradley Manning is stripped naked and held in solitary confinement, or WikiLeaks is destroyed with no due process, or war on terror victims are dressed in orange jumpsuits and tortured. They want you to know that they operate in a world of lawlessness, because that's what is supposed to instill fear. So now, to finish up this analysis, I just want to highlight what I think is the principal consequence of all of this, the reason why I find this to be such an important topic. And that is, roughly speaking, you can effectuate political change, meaningful political change, in one of two ways. You can either work within the political and legal institutions to bring about the change. You can support candidates or give money to political parties or canvass for votes and all of that. Or once you conclude that the political and legal institutions are radically corrupted, then the only viable option becomes demanding change outside of the system. And I think more than anything else, that is what this Occupy movement is about, and what has driven it is the belief, I think the clearly accurate belief, that our political and legal institutions are so completely co-opted that change is no longer able to be effectuated within it. It doesn't matter really which party wins, they're captive to the same interests, the same secretive functions of our shadow government, the national security state, the lobbyist class continue to exercise untrammeled power, that real change can come only from outside of this political system. And what's been so interesting to me about the Occupy movement, among many things, I mean, I think it's clearly, without question, easily the most exciting and inspiring development in American politics in at least a couple of decades. But the reason that it's so interesting to me and so revealing is because the reaction that it's engendered. So if you look, for example, at how the media class first reacted to Occupy Wall Street, the first reaction was, you know, I just don't understand what they are angry about. I mean, things are going so well. I mean, I think things are really going great. What does anyone have to be angry about? And then once people explain that there's this thing about mass joblessness and huge numbers of people having their homes foreclosed and exploding income and wealth inequality and the like, then they switch to, okay, but like, what's their message? What do they want? What are they really directing their anger about? And this demonization attempt was even too stupid for our political discourse, because everyone knew exactly what the message was. You could kind of begin with the name Occupy Wall Street. And look at the signs complaining about how the very people who had wrecked the world's economy through their pilfering and their fraud and their theft had been the ones who profited at the expense of everybody else. The message was pretty clear, pretty self-evident. So that didn't work. And so now they've switched to, oh, I get this. I understand. These people are basically, they're the communists. They're socialists. They just want handouts. They're mad because those people have a lot, and they don't have anything because they're lazy and not willing to work. And they want the people who have a lot to give their things to them. This is what they're protesting about. And the reason why that's not working either is because mere inequality, it's pretty clear, would not sustain or even fuel a protest movement like the one we're seeing. We've had extreme levels of wealth and income inequality for decades. It's been exploding for three decades since the Reagan era. The Reagan era was about propagating these mythological lines of propaganda designed to make Americans not just accept inequality, but cheer for it, that a rising tide lifts all boats, meaning the richer the rich get, the better it is for all of us. So Americans are relatively content with large amounts of income inequality if they perceive that it's fair and meritocratic and legitimate. So for example, when Steve Jobs dies and has $8 billion, people, by and large, don't begrudge that, because the perception is, despite the fact that there's joblessness and homelessness and foreclosures, because the perception, for better or for worse, is that he earned it. He played within the rules. He invented technologies that improved the lives of tens of millions of people. I'm not really sure how that happened, but that's the belief. And so there wasn't really anger over the mere inequality that he has $8 billion and other people are losing their homes. What people are angry about is that these inequalities have become unjust and unfair, that they're illegitimate. And the reason they're illegitimate is because the people winning are not winning because they earned it or because they deserved it. They're winning because they're cheating. These are ill-gotten gains, that they are using their power over our legal and political institutions to protect and shield and enhance at everybody else's expense. And it's this perception of illegitimacy, that our political and legal institutions have become inherently illegitimate, that have turned huge numbers of people off of the idea of working within the democratic system because it's not democratic, it's oligarchic. And instead has sent them into the streets because that's the only viable option that remains. And I'm a huge supporter of the Occupy movement. I'm thrilled to see all of that. And yet, I think any rational person should have some hesitation about living in a society in which the only effective, viable means of political change is social unrest and disruption, because it's extremely unpredictable and volatile, and it's hard to control once it's unleashed. But the reason I'm so supportive of it, notwithstanding those dangers, is because the status quo is vastly more destructive. We know for certain that the path that we're on is fundamentally wrong and dangerous and designed to lead to the collapse of everything we believe in. And that's the irony, is that the very elites who have pilfered the system have essentially sown the seeds of their own destruction, because they've forced people finally to do exactly that, which probably should have done a long time ago, and that is for citizens to band together, regardless of political ideology and backgrounds and demographics, and signal not that we want things to change or we're asking things to change, but that we're demanding it, that the status quo is no longer acceptable, and that we intend to put fear, finally, a healthy fear, in the hearts of these powerful factions that have been doing this for so long. It's they who have created the necessity for this kind of movement, and it's why I think everybody is so relieved to see it finally coming to fruition. So with that, I thank you very much for listening tonight. It was great to be with you.